Welcome to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hemmerker. In each episode, she'll talk with your favorite romantic suspense authors. They will take you behind the scenes of the writing process, giving excerpts from their writing, and share stories about their writing life.
Into the Starlight by Amanda Cabot. Joanna Vaughn has spent more than a year in Europe trying to fulfill her goal of becoming a concert pianist. With the tragic loss of her husband, her dreams are dashed, and she returns home to Sweetwater Crossing. Her childhood house is there to greet her upon her return, but she's changed so much that it no longer feels like home. Dr. Burke Finley is desperately searching for a fresh start after his fiancée married his business partner, and they both blamed him for a patient's death. He finds a reprieve when he accompanies his uncle's fiancée, Della Samuels, to Sweetwater Crossing. But his quick trip turns into an extended stay when he's caught up in an investigation over his uncle's untimely passing. At least he's able to spend some time with the lovely Joanna. Burke and Joanna join forces to help Della find the truth behind her fiancé's death. But the more time they spend together on the case, the greater their attraction grows. Both have baggage from their past that could impede any future romance. Only if they overcome their trauma can they have their happily ever after.
On this episode of The Romantic Side of Suspense, my guest is Amanda Cabot, the best-selling author of After the Shadows and Against the Wind, as well as several historical and contemporary romance series, including Muscat Springs and others. So I am delighted that she's going to be on talking about writing historical romantic suspense. So welcome to my show, Amanda.
Thanks so much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here, Sarah.
I love that I've been able to be interviewing more historical romantic suspense authors. I do love reading historical novels, both romantic suspense, romance, just mystery. I read a variety of things, as I'm sure many of us do. But for you, what do you think is the hardest part of writing romantic suspense, since you tend to write it in the 19th century? Is that your century?
It is my century, and I had people, actually friends, tell me that I was born in the wrong century. Well, maybe that's true. They think I'm a 19th century woman, but I'm not quite that old. But what is the hardest part? Ensuring that I don't reveal the villain's identity too soon, but at the same time, I need to plant enough clues that when the reader discovers who the villain is, she says, oh, of course. That makes sense. And it's that balancing act that I find to be the hardest part.
Now, I'm with you, Amanda. I don't like to reveal who the villain is, or really the big why. And I do enjoy leaving those clues, but it is hard because you don't want someone to come at the end, because we've all read books like this where we get to the end and we're like, wait a minute. How can this be? I didn't see this coming a mile away. And it's not just because they were so clever about it, I didn't guess that this person was. It was like this person came out of nowhere and like roared up as the villain. And you're like, definitely don't want that in my books either.
Well, every time I read a book like that, it is the last book I read by that author. Because that's
cheating. I know. Yes, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't mind if someone, some of my readers, they've guessed who it is. Well, that's good. Some people are going to guess. But I want the majority of them to go back and go, oh, well, that's why this was there and that was there. I can see how that conclusion works instead of, what is happening? Left field here. Coming out of left field.
Right.
I know. It's frustrating. It's frustrating. But it is tricky. It is, I think, one of the harder things for us. Suspense/mystery writers to kind of keep that under our belt. That also brings us to our plots. I mean, it can be difficult to find believable plots. So where's your inspiration for yours come from?
Well, in general, almost anywhere. But for this particular series, it all started with a house. And I think we've all seen these. You know, you go through a neighborhood and all the houses kind of fit together, and then there's one that just doesn't belong. It's so out of place with all the others. You go, what were these people thinking? Why did they build a house like that? Well, there is a house like that in Sweetwater Crossing. In fact, it's on the cover of the first book, After the Shadows. The Texas Hill Country houses tend to be relatively simple. This house looks like it belongs on a southern plantation. And you wonder, why would anyone build a house like that? Well, the answer comes, is revealed in the first couple books, which is this man from the South wants to marry his sweetheart and bring her to Texas. And her father says, son, the only way that I am going to agree to you marrying my daughter is if you give her a house like the one she's been raised in. So he decides he's going to do that. He's going to build this plantation house in Sweetwater Crossing, Texas. So that's
wow.
the first part of it. But then the real question is, what happened to him? Because the house is built right at the time when the Civil War was about to begin. He leaves Sweetwater Crossing and no one ever sees him again. And it's only in, everyone thinks they know what happened to him, but it's only in the third book, this book, Into the Starlight, that we find out what really happened to him.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm intrigued. You got, I'm hooked. We need to stop this interview right now so I can go start reading. No, just kidding.
Not okay.
Gonna, but I love that. I think that's one of the, your answer in general about, you know, anywhere and everywhere that we get our ideas. And that's the answer that most, at least for most romantic suspense authors, I find, give. And I know that can be frustrating sometimes for readers. They're like, well, what do you mean by that? I'm like, well, I guess I'm with you. You know, I might see a picture. I might see a little news snippet or a line in a, you know, in a news article or a, even another book that I go, huh, I wonder if blah, dah, dah, dot, dot, dot. And then your mind goes, and then before you know it, you have a plot.
And, you know, our minds all work differently. So you and I could see that same line in a news snippet, and we would turn out two totally different books as a result.
Yes. Yes. And I've often thought, and I have never done this, and somebody probably has, if we gave everyone, like, the same, like, picture of a house and just had them, I mean, I'm sure we could just have some wonderful, like, might be a fun short story collection, right, around either a snippet from a news article or a house, because we would all come up with different ways of interpreting even just the things we see, the things that are in the article, whatever's true, you know, those kind of things. And I think that's what makes writing so, I think, fun. And the other thing that just sometimes cracks me up is that, you know, I help aspiring writers. And occasionally they'll ask me, you know, hey, can you read X number of chapters of my new book? And, you know, if I have the time and, you know, we want to do this, I'll say sure. But sometimes they want to insist on giving me some non-disclosure thing to sign, as if I'm going to read their book and take their precious idea and run with it. And I'm like, well, first of all, you really can't trademark or copyright an idea. And second of, I could have the same idea, but I'm not going to write it like you. It's just kind of cracks me up how nervous some of them are. And I don't mean to make fun of them. It's just not quite an understanding of how the creative process works.
That's because they're new in the business. Because I mentor a number of writers, and, you know, as you said, when there is time, I will read and critique their books, do some editing on it. I've never gotten that request for a non-disclosure, but I think maybe that's because they all realize that as a writer, I mean, I can find ideas anywhere. I don't have to steal them from them.
Right.
By the way, By the way, I love your idea of giving everybody, you know, take half a dozen different authors and give us each a picture or a line of from a news article and say, write a story, and then put it together. I mean, what fun that would be.
Yeah.
We should do that.
We should do that. You know, the more I think of that, the more we find. Yeah, I did a Christmas novella collection, a limited collection last year, of Christian, this is a mouthful, Amanda, Christian romantic suspense authors writing Christmas novellas.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a tongue twister, but.
It was a tongue twister. It was a bit of a tongue twister, but that was loads of fun because everyone just, so there's 10 of us. We were, you know, in the limited collection last year, and each of us, I think, are indie publishing our novellas singly, you know, individually this year, but it was a lot of fun. But I even then I was like, no, I'm just going to do the theme Christmas. It has to be romantic suspense. You know, that was basically it. But I have thought about in the past, and now that we're discussing it, I might have to do something about it, is to have something. And then I think maybe short stories might be kind of fun. Then you could get more people in. And anyway, so listeners, perhaps maybe by the time this airs, there may be something brewing. I know Amanda's in, so.
That's right, count me in.
I will. I will definitely make sure that you know about that. So let's talk a little bit about us as kids, because I love hearing about sometimes what our dreams were as a child. What did you want to be as a child, and did that actually come true for you?
Well, I wanted to be a writer from the time that I was 7. And part of that was because my family had moved from Texas to Western New York in the middle of the winter. So talk about culture shock. Snow. I mean, what's that white stuff out there? And it was books that, and I, of course, left all my friends behind, you know, home and neighborhood. And books were my salvation at that point because I could escape into books. So I decided I wanted to be a writer. Of course, the kind of writer that I wanted to be varied by the year. For a while, I thought I'd be a playwright. And I produced a couple plays for my elementary school class. And they never made it to Broadway. Then I thought I might be a journalist. But eventually I realized that what I really, really wanted to be was a novelist, because that's what I like reading most, are novels. And at the time, I wanted to write romantic suspense, and I'm going to date myself at this point by telling you that the authors that I wanted to be most like were Mary Stuart and Phyllis Whitney.
There's no dating. Hey, everyone reads. Doesn't everyone read those, even though they're older?
I
mean, I love those. Those were great.
And that's what I wanted to do. Then I saw an ad for Harlequin romances. Didn't even know what they were, but I thought, you know, maybe I should start the easy way and write pure romance and then add the suspense elements later. So that's exactly what I did. I wound up writing a short contemporary romance, and then ultimately I got to where I wanted to be, which is where I am now, which is writing Christian fiction with a suspense element, a romance, but with a suspense element in it.
Yeah, and then there. And then how did you get into the historical?
Well, I wrote... I said, I wrote a couple contemporaries, but then I thought, you know, it'd be really fun to write a historical because, like you, I read a lot of different genres, and I really enjoyed historicals. So when I started writing historicals, I thought, you know, this is what I really like to do. I like portraying what life was like in a different era. I mean, people think, well, the 19th century was simpler life. Oh, really? They didn't have air conditioning. They didn't have electricity. Well, some of them had electricity. How about indoor plumbing? You know, but it's a whole different lifestyle, and it's fun for me to bring that lifestyle to life for my readers.
Yeah, no, I love that, and I so admire historical fiction writers, because I know how much research you have to do, and that's frankly why even though I love history and I do like research, I don't have the time to do enough research to write a historical one. Mm-hmm. So I have enough research to do to write the contemporaries, and I'm like, okay, if I actually want to have time to actually write, I need to stick to contemporary. But I enjoy reading them. So, you know, I know it can be tricky to make sure your books are accurate. So how does that work for you? What do you do to ensure that your books are accurate, given that they didn't have the internet back then? So, you know,
no.
Where do you find it?
Lots of research, as you said. I have several historical books. There's one that is like the Bible for Texas history. It's called Lone Star. And that gives me all the facts that I need about what was happening. I have Lucy Barton's Historic Costume for the Stage, which is an incredible book for what did people wear. And it doesn't just show you pictures. It tells you what were the fabrics, what were the colors that they used. Some of them were pretty garish, but, you know, okay. And then, of course, I mean, I check things because I have a pet peeve, which is anachronisms, you know. So I want to make sure that I don't have somebody stringing a barbed wire fence before they were made. But even more than that, the thing that bothers me the most is anachronisms in vocabulary.
Oh,
I can't tell you how much time I spend with my dictionary checking for the date of first usage.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to like the words camouflage and sabotage. I can't use those because those came into common usage during World War I, not the 19th century. So if I were going to put that in there, now, it might not bother any readers or many readers, but I'm telling you, if I read that in somebody's 19th century book, I'd go, well, she sure didn't do her research on this.
Right.
And
I think it just adds that extra layer. I mean, whether we're writing historical or contemporary, that extra layer of authenticity that draws our readers into the story. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I live out right outside of Washington, D.C. in Northern Virginia, and I will read that people, you know, somebody drove from Northern Virginia to, you know, someplace in Maryland, and it took them like 20 minutes. I'm like, even on a good day, that is just not possible. Stuff like that, or they'll refer to the metro system, which is called the metro system, as the subway, and I'm like, one book I read had a metro stop at the White House. I'm like, you should not have that because of national security and a whole host of ways, but definitely not. There's no metro stop at the White House.
Those things are so easy to find. I'm sure that you can find a map of the metro system online.
Pretty easy.
So
pretty easy.
How lazy was the author that she didn't check that? You know?
Or he didn't. Sometimes it's a guy.
He didn't, I mean, it just, that's the kind of stuff that just annoys me because, yes, it takes time to do it, but we owe that to our readers to immerse them into a world that's a realistic world. And if we don't, then honestly, I think we've failed.
We haven't. I can't afford, I don't know about you, Amanda, but I can't afford to alienate any readers, so I do my best. And there's sometimes when I, you know, we have to change or move or slight things, but I make it so it's not like, you know, a really kind of jarring thing, like a metro stop at the White House, but a simpler thing, you know, that's okay, that people can go, oh, well, she knows all this stuff. If you're here, perhaps I, you know, switched a coffee shop out on, you know, on a street or something, but that they'll forgive you for those kind of things, but they won't for the more obvious, this would never happen because X, Y, Z. So yeah, it's, it pays to do the research. And for the historical, there's that whole other layer of research that you have to do.
True.
Well, thank you. We are out of time. I am so sorry. I could keep talking with you, Amanda. This has been delightful. So thank you so much for being on my show and for sharing about your writing journey.
And thanks for having me, Sarah. I've really enjoyed our time together.
And listeners, remember, stay tuned and you'll hear an excerpt from Into the Starlight by Amanda Cabot.
Now an excerpt from Into the Starlight by Amanda Cabot. Friday, September 14th, 1883. Dreams weren't supposed to die, but Joanna Richter's had, all except one. The concerts at Munich's glorious Odeon and Vienna's incomparable Musikverein had nurtured the dream she'd cherished for almost as long as she could remember, but it had crumbled, destroyed by something the doctors told her was invisible to the human eye. The majesty of the Swiss Alps had sown the seeds of another dream, one that had withered before it could fully flower. Now, there was only one left. Joanna smiled as she entered Sweetwater Crossing. It might lack the museums and monuments that Grandmother Kenner had called the essentials of a civilized city, but this small town in the Texas Hill Country had something far more valuable, her home. It wouldn't be the same with both Mama and Father gone, but the house itself wouldn't have changed. It would shelter her, and maybe, just maybe, she'd be able to find a new purpose for her life here, a chance to finally be the best at something. She slowed the buggy, wanting to savor the first few minutes of her homecoming. Other than the new parsonage that had been built after the last one burned, the town looked the same, and oh, how comforting that was. She'd once sought change. Now she valued stability. Being here would provide that. Warmth flooded through Joanna's veins as she turned onto Creek Road and approached her destination. It was there, just as she remembered it. Her smile broadened as she gazed at the building where she'd spent most of her life. The stone that Clive Finley had chosen for the three-story house was strong and durable, unlikely to crumble or burn, giving her a feeling of safety and security. The columns that supported the veranda stood tall, as though proud that their role was more than decorative, or so Joanna had claimed when she was a child. The double staircase served as a reminder that there was more than one way to reach a destination, and the three dormer windows seemed to herald the presence of the three Vaughn girls, even though she and her sisters never slept in those rooms. Her sisters had laughed when she described the house that way, saying she was being fanciful. Perhaps she was, but this was Joanna's home, her beloved home. It hadn't changed, though she had, as one by one, her dreams had vanished. She frowned at the memory of why she'd been so eager to leave Sweetwater Crossing. The disappointment that had verged on despair. The overwhelming sense of failure. The realization that there would be no happily ever after with a handsome rancher for her. That dream had been the first to die. Fortunately, she had told no one, not even her sisters, what she'd dreamt. And now, there was no need. As she had so often in the past, Joanna guided the buggy between the stone pillars marking the entrance to Finley House and along the curved drive that led to the house itself. When she'd reined in the horse, she inhaled deeply in an attempt to calm her nerves, regretting the action a second later. It was only when the pain in her lungs subsided that Joanna could climb out of the buggy, and even then, her hands had begun to shake. It was one thing to know that her parents were not there, quite another to enter the house that held so many memories and not see them. Reminding herself to take shallow breaths, she mounted the front steps and knocked on the door. After a year and a half, Joanna Vaughn Richter was home. It seemed forever, but was no more than 30 seconds before the door opened, and the petite blonde with deep blue eyes, who looked so much like Mama that Joanna could hardly breathe, stared at her.
Joanna?
The woman's voice trembled more than Joanna's hands had, and her eyes widened in what appeared to be shock.
Is it really you?
Joanna nodded, It's me, Emily. The last time she'd seen her older sister had been only hours after Emily's wedding, when she and her handsome groom had left Sweetwater Crossing to return to George's ranch. Emily had been beautiful then. Everyone in town acknowledged her as the prettiest of the Vaughn girls. But that beauty paled compared to the Emily who now smiled at Joanna. There was a new softness to her sister's face, a gleam in her eyes that hadn't been there before, transforming her into the picture of a happy woman. I can't believe it! Emily took a step forward and wrapped her arms around Joanna's waist, as she'd done so many times when they'd been children. It had become more awkward once Joanna grew to her full height, half a foot taller than Emily. But Emily had always persisted in her efforts to soothe Joanna when she'd been distressed. Today, it was Emily who appeared distressed.
Louisa and I've been so worried about you.
I'm sorry. Though the words were inadequate, they were the only ones Joanna had. I should have written, but I couldn't. For so many reasons. Emily broke the hug, then reached out to take one of Joanna's hands and lead her indoors.
It doesn't matter. Nothing matters except that you're back and safe.
Despite the warmth of the September day, the house was cool. That shouldn't have been a problem, but something triggered a coughing spasm, the first Joanna had had since she'd arrived in Texas. The doctors had warned her against becoming overly excited. Perhaps that was the cause, because there was no doubt that she was excited to be home. Excited, and at the same time a bit apprehensive, knowing that even though the house itself had not changed, many other things had. She bent over, trying to stop the coughing. When she could again breathe freely, she looked at her sister.
I'm sorry, she said, wondering how many more times she would have to apologize.
Emily's blue eyes, so different from Joanna's brown ones, reflected concern.
You're ill. What can I do? Should I call Louisa?
As if she'd only just registered the unrelieved black Joanna wore, Emily asked,
Why are you in mourning? Was it your grandmother?
She shook her head.
Oh, listen to me. I should be helping you, but instead I'm bombarding you with questions.
It's all right, Emily. When they were growing up, Emily had felt that her role as the oldest meant she had to care for Joanna and Louisa, and that caring had included what had sometimes felt like an inquisition. I should probably sit down and drink a bit of water. The air here was heavier than it had been in the Alps, and the doctors said that could make breathing more difficult.
Of course.
Emily wrapped her arm around Joanna's waist again.
Let's go to the kitchen. I've got pudding on the stove, and if I leave it too long, it'll be a scorched mess.
Once Joanna was seated at the kitchen table with a glass of water in front of her, Emily began to stir something that smelled like chocolate. We have a few minutes to talk before Mrs. Carmichael and Noah come back from their walk. She paused and turned to look at Joanna.
Noah's my son, my adopted son. And you remember Mrs. Carmichael. She takes care of Noah while Craig is at school.
A chuckle accompanied Emily's explanation. There I go again. If you got my letters, you know all that. Craig tells me I'm prone to chatter when I'm excited. There was no missing the smile that crossed Emily's face when she spoke of her husband, her second husband. Joanna brushed aside thoughts of George. Nothing good would come from thinking of him, just as nothing good would come from remembering how often she'd wished she'd been a petite blonde like Emily instead of a tall brunette. Especially when George had had eyes only for Emily.
The last letter I received said you were going to marry the schoolteacher, and that Louisa brought a man with a broken leg to recuperate here.
Oh my! Emily made no effort to hide her dismay.
That was months ago. So much has happened since then. Louisa did more than set Josh's leg. She married him. Little sister Louisa was married. Joanna knew she shouldn't have been surprised, and yet she was. Before she could speak, Emily continued, "I don't understand why you didn't receive my letters. I thought it only took a few weeks for mail to reach Munich." "I haven't been in Munich since early February." Though she tried to suppress it, Joanna coughed again. "I caught scarlet fever and had almost died, although she wouldn't worry Emily with that information. It turned into pneumonia. That's when Grandmother took me to Switzerland because the air was supposed to be better there. She arranged for mail to be forwarded, but it appears most of it wasn't." Abandoning the pudding for a moment, Emily gave Joanna a quick hug. "My letters don't matter, but I hate that you were sick and so far away. I wish I'd known." It might have been comforting to have Emily or Louisa with her during the long recovery, but they would have tried to convince her to return home. And at that point, Joanna had still entertained dreams of an illustrious career and hadn't wanted anyone to try to dissuade her. "There was nothing you could have done. The sanatorium was one of the best in Europe, and the treatments helped." "As much as they could." Joanna paused, debating whether to tell her sister the final prognosis, then decided she might as well be honest. "The doctors warned me that my lungs will always be weak." Too weak to allow her to continue her training and eventually embark on a concert tour of her own. "But if I'm careful, I can live normally." Emily fixed one of her appraising looks on Joanna. "I'll make sure you're careful, and so will Louisa." Joanna smiled, knowing they would. Emily would cook meals she was certain would strengthen her, and Louisa would study medical books to determine whether anything more could be done. "I'm so glad you're home again." Emily returned to stirring the pudding. "The important thing is for you to rest, and there's no better place than right here." Though her sister's gesture encompassed more than the kitchen, Joanna studied the room where she'd spent so many hours watching Mama cook and then helping her wash the dishes. The curtains at the window were new, but that was the only change she could see, other than Mama's absence. The wooden table where Joanna had eaten cookies after school still had the small gouge from a broken glass, and the cupboards still had mismatched knobs after Louisa had unscrewed one and lost it in the yard. It was a simple room compared to some of the chateaux she'd visited, but that simplicity was a balm to Joanna's spirits. "I feel better just being here." Emily tasted the pudding, then added another spoonful of sugar. "I hope you're not angry that I turned our home into a boarding house." For the first time since Joanna had entered the house, her sister's voice held a note of uncertainty. "How could I be angry? You did what you had to save our home." Though the news that both of her parents had died had been devastating, Joanna understood the actions her older sister had taken to ensure that Finley House would remain the family home. "Now that I'm here, I can help you, if you still have a room for me, that is." "No helping until you're fully recovered, but of course there's room for you. Beulah's in your bedroom. I could move her, but I'd rather not, now that she's become accustomed to it. Would you mind moving into my old room or Louisa's? She and Josh have taken over the third floor." More changes. The thought of returning to the room she'd had for as long as she could remember had buoyed Joanna during the long journey from Europe. Now it appeared that that dream had also died. What other changes were awaiting her? Beulah? Rather than upset Emily by admitting her disappointment that her room hadn't been kept for her, Joanna seized on the familiar name. "Beulah Douglas lives here?" Emily nodded. "I thought I'd written about that. She stays here during the week so she can attend school, then goes home on Friday afternoon. It's been a good arrangement for everyone, especially Noah. He misses her on the weekends. A shadow crossed Emily's lovely face. There I go again, talking about other things. You haven't told me why you're in mourning, but I assume it's for your grandmother. When did she die? A few hours after my husband.
Thanks for listening to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hammerker. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. You can sign up to receive notifications of upcoming podcasts and listen to previous editions at sarahhammerkerfiction.com.